This week on Capitalism, Race and Democracy.
During the period of the Cold War, a lot of small arms have been poured into the Horn of Africa, including in Somalia. And this is a major factor which was fueling the conflict, of course, from the very beginning. I mean, this is an involvement of the West, which is often forgotten today, that it didn't start in the 90s, it started in the 80s, even in the 70s.
We spend the hour discussing Somalia with anthropology professor Marcus Virgil Hanna.
Despite the fact that Somalis are having this kind of flexibility when it comes to uniting for common cause or against a common enemy and fragmenting internally, though this is really characteristic of Somali society, you know, Somali nationalism is very strong.
Somalis have always united against external aggression, but then fragmented along clan lines.
At the same time, due to the fact that Somalis are all connected along kinship lines, these connections hold water even among those Somalis who fled the country decades ago.
Somalia is developing rapidly with the support of the Somali diaspora, despite its internal fragmentation. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Somalia is a nation of roughly 19 million people and territory roughly the size of Texas. It sits on the mouth of the Red Sea, very near the Strait of Hormuz, at the intersection of the European, African, and Asian worlds. Its coastline is the longest on mainland Africa. Israel's wars on Gaza and now Iran, and the naval presence of all the world's great powers, now make it more geostrategic than ever. Most all Somalis speak the same language, share the same culture, and practice Sunni Islam. For centuries, they have united against invasion, colonization, and other forms of foreign aggression. But clan rivalry has made it difficult for Somalis to establish a cohesive national identity and central government. Upon independence, they sought to create a greater Somalia, including all the ethnic Somalis in the Horn of Africa. But today, Somalia is one of the most conflict-wrecked nations on the continent. Despite internal conflict, terrorism, and a weak central government, Somalia keeps developing, largely due to diaspora support. This week, we spend the entire hour with anthropology professor Marcus Virgil Hanna, senior lecturer at the Institute of Social and Cultural Anthropology at the University of Göttingen, Germany, who speaks the Somali language and has studied Somali issues since 2001. Professor, Somalia is one of the few ethnically homogeneous nations in sub-Saharan Africa, but at the same time, one of the most conflict-wracked. Why is this the case, even though its people all speak the Somali language, share the same culture, and practice Sunni Islam?
Yeah, that's a really interesting puzzle, because if you compare Somalia with most other sub-Saharan African states, you would have, in most other states, you would have partly dozens of different ethnic groups, many of which would also speak different languages. And in Somalia, as you said, you have Somalis who are speaking Somali language. They are dialects, but I mean, largely people speak or at least understand standard Somali. They are culturally very similar. As you said, they are largely Sunni Muslims. So actually, it would be a prime example for an ethnic nation state in sub-Saharan Africa, one of the very few ethnic nation states in sub-Saharan Africa. At the same time, it's the longest standing case of so-called state collapse in the world, I guess, since 1991, so over 34 years by now. Why is it so? Several factors would explain that. So one factor which has been poorly understood a few years ago, but now it's very clear, is, of course, that Somali society is based on what in anthropology and social anthropology we would call a segmentary lineage system. So there's lots of different patrilineal descent groups. You can say, as a shorthand, a lot of different clans. But of course, clans divide into subclans, subclans divide into lineages, lineages divide into extended families. So it's like a cascade of groupings, all connected in the Somali case through patrilineal descent. And it's a hallmark of segmentary lineage systems like the Somali society. People can very flexibly unite. They can forge defense against an external enemy, but they also very quickly fragment again. So, as long as there is a powerful external enemy, like for instance, in the 1970s, Ethiopia was an external enemy of Somalia, it's rather easy to unite Somalis against the external threat. But once the external enemy disappeared and there's kind of misunderstandings in the internal misunderstandings, political wrangling, competition, then Somalis very quickly divide themselves into smaller groups, so-called clans or subclans. And this is one factor. So this explains, let's say, a certain degree of political instability. However, additionally, a factor which really explains the long-term state collapse is also the masses of small arms which have been imported into the Horn of Africa during the period of the Cold War. So from the 1960s onward, I mean, right from independence, Somalia was integrated into the Cold War rivalry between, let's say, the Western Bloc and the Eastern Bloc. And both sides actually supplied Somalia, but also other countries in the Horn of Africa, including, of course, Ethiopia, with small arms. And when there was this regime change in 1991, when the military dictatorship under President Mohamed Siad Barre, who had been supported by the US through the 1980s, when Mohamed Siad Barre was toppled, basically the arsenals were open. The rebels got access to all the military equipment and this poured into society. So it was not even controlled by the rebels, but basically the Somali society became fully armed in the early 1990s. So in combination with this kind of fluid and unstable political segmentary lineage system, you can imagine what this does. Every family is now armed, and people unite and divide very quickly. So everybody builds a militia. There are flexible alliances between militias, grabbing strategic resources like ports or airports or junctions or plantations. And the whole thing becomes a real mess. And this is exactly what happened in the early 90s. And the repercussions are still existing today.
Okay, could you talk about the issues of nationalism versus secessionism?
Yeah, I mean, this is again another interesting puzzle, if you like. I mean, despite the fact that Somalis having this kind of flexibility when it comes to uniting for a common cause or against a common enemy and fragmenting internally, though this is really characteristic of Somali society, Somali nationalism is very strong. I mean, this overlays, if you like, all these clan or sub-clan divisions. Somali nationalism emerged in the 1940s to colonial influence. The British and also the Italians and the French, they were dividing the Horn of Africa among themselves in the late 19th, early 20th century. But in the course of the Second World War, Great Britain actually captured most of the Horn of Africa, I mean, particularly the Italian territories from Eritrea to southern Somalia, and in between, Italy was also occupying Ethiopia between 1935 and 1941. So the Second World War also took place in the Horn of Africa, and in 1942, the British military actually took control of much of the Horn of Africa, including almost all the Somali territories and Ethiopia. And this was a period when pretty much all of the Somalis in the Horn of Africa were united under one political system, right? I mean, there's a lot of ethnic Somalis also living in eastern Ethiopia, in northeastern Kenya, and so on. So during this British military occupation, 1942 onwards, for a few years, all Somalis were united under one administration. And this was also a time when, I think, also fostered by the British military administration, the first national parties emerged, the first Somali national parties, for instance, the Somali Youth League, which was the biggest Somali party in those days. And they created this kind of political consciousness. And Somalis had, as we said earlier, they had already this cultural basis. They were all connected, so to say, through religion, through language, through certain other cultural features. And in the 1940s, you could add to that a political consciousness. So we really want to be governed, to say, by ourselves across the Horn of Africa. And this created a very strong nationalist movement, which, however, didn't overcome strategic interests of other powers. So Ethiopia, of course, which was back then governed by Emperor Haile Selassie, had a very strong interest to keep Somali divided. Ethiopia, so to say, claimed a huge part of the Somali territory in the east, the so-called Ogaden territory, and they wanted to have it back. So the British returned it to Ethiopia in 1954, which again stirred up a lot of nationalist sentiment among Somalis in opposition to Ethiopia. And also the Italian territories after the Second World War were given to Italy again as a United Nations trusteeship. So Italy, despite the fact that they actually lost the Second World War, were returned as a colonial power to southern Somalia, but only with the obligation to let Somalis become independent in 1960. So 1960 became the most important date for Somali nationalism because this was when actually the North, which is today Somaliland, back then it was a British protectorate, the North gained independence. The South, which was Italian administrated, gained independence in 1960. And in July 1960, both of these territories united to form the Somali Republic. And all the Somali politicians back then had the big aim to forge what they call Greater Somalia, which would have included Somali territories in the Ogaden in eastern Ethiopia, but also in northeastern Kenya, and also parts of Djibouti. That all should have become part of Greater Somalia, but this collided with all the interests of the neighboring countries. So Somali nationalism was a very strong force in the 1960s, 1970s, but it also faced a lot of opposition, particularly from Ethiopia and from Kenya, who were not ready to give up the Somali territories. And this led to several wars with Kenya in the late 1960s, but also with Ethiopia, particularly in 1977, 78, which was the so-called Ogaden War. Somalia lost this war, and this was the beginning of the fragmentation time. So Somali nationalism had its peak, so to say, in the mid-1970s. And after the defeat of the Somali army in the Ogaden War, more and more people, political elites inside Somalia started questioning the government under Mohamed Siad Barre. And then Mohamed Siad Barre himself, who in the early 1970s propagated nationalism and tried to overcome clan divisions, in the late 70s, early 80s, when his power was kind of weakening, he clinged to clan, so to say, to his own clan basis. So this was a period when then the state collapse in Somalia actually started in the early 1970s in the wake of the Ogaden War, and escalated through the 1980s with different militias emerging and fighting the central government. Again, you can explain it with fusion and fission. You know, fusion like Somali nationalism against all the others. And once it didn't work out, fission started. And in the 1980s, the government became weaker and weaker, and the rebels became stronger and stronger. And everybody relied on his or her clan basis. And this is how nationalism then again declined, if you like, in the late 1980s, early 1990s. And then, of course, Somaliland, which you already mentioned in northwestern Somalia, declared its independence in 1991. It was a unilateral declaration of independence. And this, in a way, was like the end of Somali nationalism, because, in a way, they reclaimed colonial division. Like Somalis in the 1960s and 70s had worked for unification. And then, with the declaration of Somaliland's independence in 1991, this was a return to colonial division, which is very much resisted among many Somalis up until today. So this is a pending issue, you know, the question of Somali unity versus the secession of Somaliland from Somalia. That's a pending issue. And Somali nationalism is, so to say, at a very weak moment, I would say, currently. So there's a lot of divisions, there's a lot of fragmentation, and this is also used by neighboring countries. I mean, Ethiopia, Kenya, Uganda, also the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, but also European powers, also the US and Turkey. Everybody is currently involved in Somalia, and everybody finds certain partners and supports certain partners against all the others.
And smaller fragmented states are weaker in the face of foreign ambitions and resource interests, right?
Absolutely. Everybody tries to get a piece of the cake. You know, everybody tries to strike a deal with some parochial power. Like, for instance, currently Turkey is very close to the current Somali government in Mogadishu. So they try to get oil concessions from the government. However, this government doesn't control very much of Somalia. It controls pretty much the capital city, and that's it. And in the background, you have, as you already mentioned earlier, Al-Shabaab, which is an Islamist movement close to, it's aligned to Al-Qaeda. And these guys, in a way, even if it sounds paradoxical, these guys are, so to say, in reality, a bit more nationalist than all the others. You know, they are, because they provide an alternative political orientation. Of course, it's an Islamist ideology which they preach. However, they really, if you look at what they are stating in their manifests, they are fighting against what they call black colonialists, which would be Kenya, Ethiopia, Uganda, to restore the Somali nation, of course, under Islamic rule.
Well, Somalia is an Islamic state. It's just not as extreme as Al-Shabaab would like, right?
Of course, absolutely.
Okay.
In their reading, the Somali government and many others who work together with the Western powers or with other powers like Turkey and so on, they have been corrupted.
Okay. I'm a little worried that that almost makes Al-Shabaab sound too good.
That's one of the things which is so tragic about Somalia, that in a way, always the wrong guys get empowered by external actors, right? And this makes it very easy for groups like Al-Shabaab to say, you know, look, you know, the Americans are working with the warlords. The warlords are killers. The warlords are to blame for all the misery. You know, they are to blame for what happened in the 1990s. So we are the good guys. We are the Somali Muslims. We are, you know, fighting for the dignity of Somalia. And in order to get rid of all this bad heritage of violence, you know, corruption and everything, let's turn to religion. That's in a way the logic, and it's not completely wrong. Of course, the extreme interpretation of Islam is not Somali. That's alien to Somalis. And that's also not popular among many Somalis. However, this argument that the Westerners always work together with the wrong guys, and we are actually the ones who support Somali dignity, and we are really working for Somali prosperity, this argument is easy to make for groups like Al-Shabaab, you know, in the face of what's really going on. The United Nations, since decades, knowingly supports corrupt, violent actors. So what do you think what a Somali nomad from the countryside thinks about the UN? Not much, right? But if a guy comes and say, hey, I'm building a school, I'm building a mosque, we get some money, you know, we provide you with some seats, and you follow us, and we are anyway the good Muslims, we are anyway the guys who defend Islam, a Somali nomad will say, yes, I'm joining you guys. That's true. Sounds
wow.
Good.
Okay. Again, I'm afraid you made him sound pretty good. Maybe you should tell me just what is wrong with Al-Shabaab. I can understand all these arguments you've made and how it could be persuasive, but what's wrong with Al-Shabaab?
Yeah, wrong with Al-Shabaab is they basically kill a lot of Somalis. They resort to undefensible violence, and they basically consider everybody who is not following them an unbeliever, including many Somalis. So this is a takfir ideology which they adhere to. And this caused a lot of havoc among Somalis. I mean, they turned really into a killing machine. And like 90% of the victims are Somalis. So this is, of course, not making any sense for most other Somalis.
That exchange about that is very helpful.
I don't want to sugarcoat Al-Shabaab, but it's wrong to only point the finger to Al-Shabaab and say, oh, that's the problem. You know, once we got rid of, you can quote me on that.
Okay.
This whole idea that, oh, once we defeated Al-Shabaab, Somalia will be fine, is the wrong idea. That's for sure. Because once you defeated Al-Shabaab, and anyway, it's a big question why Al-Shabaab has not yet been defeated, because their enemies are overpowerful. Mm-hmm. But once Al-Shabaab is defeated and the last Al-Shabaab fighter has been buried, the problems of Somalia, based on enormous corruption, absolute mistrust between the different political actors and groups, will persist. That's a tragedy. So Al-Shabaab is not the biggest problem of Somalia. The biggest problem is the lack of trust, the lack of reconciliation. You know, no political force which has been trying to bring peace to Somalia ever in the last 25 years has really invested into grassroots reconciliation. Everybody tries just to build some kind of, how do you say, good-looking institution in the government, in the capital, right? The UN, the US, the European Union, and now, of course, also all the other actors, everybody tried to just create this kind of facade. You know, there's a president, there's a prime minister, there are ministers, there's a parliament, there's elections, now there's a constitution. They want to turn to one person, one vote. This is not leading to peace in Somalia, because underneath, there are all these grievances dating from the late 1980s up until today, the past 40 years of grievances of Clan A against Clan B, Group A against Group B. All the horrible things which happened, nobody ever wanted to talk about. I mean, nobody really tried to talk about it carefully. And I think without tackling these issues and really coming together among Somalis and saying, hey, what did we do to each other? How can we forgive each other? How can we build a new social and political system which serves everybody, which everybody can trust also? There will be no peaceful future for Somalia. Sounds maybe a bit pathetic, but really that's what I think is happening. So Al-Shabaab is more or less like a straw man. It's used. Oh, everybody has to fight Al-Shabaab. Yeah, but first of all, Al-Shabaab is strangely enough not defeated so far, even it's a rather small group compared to its enemies. And second of all, once Al-Shabaab has been defeated, the corruption and the mistrust in the system remains.
You are listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. After this short break, we'll get back to our conversation about Somalia with anthropology professor Marcus Virgil Hanna. That was Ahmed Rasta. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. Today we're speaking with Professor Marcus Virgil Hanna about Somalia.
How have the rest of the world, and particularly the U.S., been involved in Somalia's internal struggles?
Yeah, I said initially in this conversation that during the period of the Cold War, a lot of small arms have been poured into the Horn of Africa, including in Somalia. And this is a major factor which was fueling the conflict, of course, from the very beginning. I mean, this is an involvement of the West, which is often forgotten today, that it didn't start in the 90s. It started in the 80s, even in the 70s. So a lot of arms have been imported into the Horn of Africa. The second involvement, which is still, you know, relevant today, is that through the 1980s, particularly, the American government has supported the military dictatorship of Somalia. The socialist military dictatorship of Ethiopia had been supported by the Soviet Union, and the, so to say, not socialist anymore military dictatorship of Siad Barre in the 1980s had been supported by Washington. Siad Barre was a highly valued strategic ally of Washington in the 1980s. And the U.S. government knew that he was committing horrible, his government was committing horrible human rights violations. They knew that he was kind of area bombarding parts of northern Somalia, including the civilians in Hargeisa and in Bro. They knew it. And they still supported this regime, which would have fallen, of course, without U.S. support, which have fallen much earlier. So again, this is an involvement, this is a legacy, so to say, Western involvement in Somalia, which has not really been discussed much in the last few years, but it's still important. And then the next involvement of Western powers, of course, came during the humanitarian intervention in the early 90s. So when, you know, Somalia fell apart and civil war mushroomed or spread across Somalia, and including which caused also a famine in southern Somalia between 1991 and 1992. The U.S. government back then under George Bush, still George Bush, the elder, and the UN under Boutros-Ghali were deciding to launch a humanitarian intervention in Somalia in order to safeguard the starving population, which was a noble cause for sure. I think there was no hidden agenda. I think in 1991, 1992, when this humanitarian intervention was decided, I think it was, so to say, you know, the peak of Western, you know, happiness about, you know, having won the Cold War and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So I think the idea was to make Somalia a test case for, you know, the new humanitarianism, new internationalism. So we can solve problems. You know, the UN and the US together can solve problems. And Somalia became the test case. Unluckily, it went dramatically wrong. Right. I mean, once American troops were on the ground, supported by UN peacekeeping forces, they started making sure that the starving population received humanitarian aid, food aid. At the same time, they got involved in the politics, in Somali politics. And at one point in 1993, they identified one of the warlords, Mohamed Farah Hadid, as the main obstacle for peace. And they thought, we can simply arrest him. And they didn't calculate, you know, they didn't calculate with this staunch resistance of his planned supporters. Mm-hmm. So suddenly then again, this, you know, this fusion and fission dynamic kicked in. Previously, Mohamed Farah Hadid was just one of many warlords and he had a lot of internal enemies. But once the Americans, as an external force, singled him out as the bad guy, everybody united. Even those people who didn't like him fought for him against the outsiders. And this was when Black Hawk Down happened, you know. And Black Hawk Down, I mean, from a military perspective, wasn't so dramatic. I mean, 18 American GI soldiers were killed. If you compare it with the casualties America took in Iraq and Afghanistan, it's actually nothing. But, you know, back then it was the biggest loss of American forces outside of America, you know, after Vietnam. Mm. It was a big propaganda issue. And Bill Clinton had to withdraw the American forces after Black Hawk Down. But this, again, was an involvement which had long-term repercussions, because in this context of the external intervention, particularly also the United Nations, they cooperated with certain warlords, not with Mohamed Farah Hadid eventually, but with others, and made them important political players. And this gave the Somali warlords, who, you know, before the intervention had just been, you know, at eye level with each other and fighting each other, this elevated some of them into major political players. And also the logic of these external powers was, if you want to stabilize Somalia, you have to talk with the bad guys. You have to talk with these militia leaders, and they have to become, you know, president, prime minister, minister, so and so. And this kind of logic, which also, by the way, was applied to Afghanistan after 2001, the first cabinets which were established after the intervention were all warlord cabinets. The same thing happened in Somalia. So the UN, in a way, fostered warlords as political players, which again had a long-term effect on what happened in Somalia.
Could you talk about it from 2006 to now, which is the period more people are going to be at least somewhat familiar with?
Yeah, I mean, this is, again, this Somalia became part of this global war on terror after the horrible attacks on New York and Washington in 2001. I mean, the first target of American, you know, revenge, if you like, was Afghanistan, of course, and then Iraq became a place of external military intervention led by the US. Somalia could have become also a place of military intervention because it was a place, you know, it's all Sunni Muslims, and they had some long-standing connections to some, you know, extremist actors, including Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, some of those guys who later on featured in Afghanistan. They had also been around in Somalia in the 1990s at one point. So I'm sure the American government was aware of that, and they were contemplating intervening in Somalia. But given the, you know, the traumatic experience in the early 90s, you know, in Mogadishu, the Black Hawk Down event, America refrained from direct military intervention in the wake of, you know, the war on terror, and basically launched an indirect war on terror in Somalia, which was mostly carried out by Ethiopia and Somali warlords in, you know, 2002, 3, 4, 5. And this indirect war on terror, which was targeting certain Islamist actors, particularly in Mogadishu, led to an Islamic insurgency. So, I mean, in defense against this kind of anti-Islamic activities financed by the U.S., coordinated by Ethiopia and executed by Somali warlords, the Somali Islamist forces united in 2005, 2006, and actually battled the warlords in Somalia and won control over Mogadishu in mid-2006. So the Somali courts, Islamic courts, which were compared to the Taliban at one point, took control of Mogadishu in mid-2006. Which caused a lot of concern in Washington and in Europe, in Brussels and so on, and led to an Ethiopian military intervention against these Islamic courts in December 2006, which was logistically supported by Washington. And then after the Islamic court union had been crushed by the Ethiopian military forces, a very small vanguard, if you like, remained on the ground, and this was actually Al-Shabaab. So they reordered in early 2007, they reestablished themselves, and they got a lot of support because, again, as I said, you know, once there's an outside enemy, Somalis tend to unite against the outside enemy. So the Ethiopian military intervention against the Islamic courts constituted such an outside act of enmity. And in early 2007, Al-Shabaab received a lot of support from all corners of Somalia against the Ethiopians. And this was also how Al-Shabaab became big. So my argument would be, you know, Al-Shabaab, which is today considered as a major Islamist political militant actor in the Horn of Africa, which is an Al-Qaeda affiliate, Al-Shabaab, as we know it today, is a direct product of counterterrorism. Even this sounds a little bit counterintuitive to some people, but if you look at the history of that, the events in Somalia, this argument can really be sustained. So Al-Shabaab became big in defense of its own people against Ethiopian military intervention. So that's how Al-Shabaab became big. Before that, it was just a group of maybe 400 or 500 extremist guys who didn't have much support in Somalia. But once the Ethiopians crashed into Somalia, hundreds and hundreds and eventually thousands of Somalis supported Al-Shabaab.
And that's the Ethiopians with the backing of the U.S., right?
Exactly. Absolutely.
Okay. And what about the bombing campaign since 2007? The U.S. has been bombing since 2007, and Al-Shabaab seems only to have gotten stronger. What's with that?
Yeah, I mean, this kind of drone warfare and bombing campaigns, which is happening in Somalia, you're right. I mean, as I guess in many other places where this happens, you know, there's a lot of what some people cynically would call collateral damage. I mean, once you kill, you know, the wrong guys, you know, their brothers and sisters and their uncles and fathers and so on, they join the other side, right? I mean, once, you know, some guys are hit by a drone or by a rocket mistakenly, then many of their relatives, and in Somalia, it's always relatives, you know, they tend to take revenge by then eventually joining, for instance, Al-Shabaab or other groups like that. And and the other thing is why these bombing campaigns actually have not been so effective. I mean, Al-Shabaab is blending into the local society. They are very clever in the sense that they do not have so many, you know, identifiable military infrastructure in places even where they operate and even places which they control. they typically blend into the local society, though they are very difficult to bomb, if you like, unless you take a lot of civilian casualties, you accept a lot of civilian casualties. Yeah. So, but these bombing campaigns, yeah, there have been quite a few, you know, successful bombing campaigns against Al-Shabaab in the last few years. Following this news coming out of Somalia, I would say particularly 2022, 23, and so on, in the last few 4 years, a lot of Al-Shabaab fighters have been also neutralized by drones. But nevertheless, obviously, the group manages to, you know, recruit, you know, those people who they are missing. I mean, they managed to recruit in the Somali population. And so far, they kept the military momentum on their side.
What role do resource issues play in the conflict? In your book, Somaliland and Puntland, Between Somaliland and Puntland, you wrote, quote, if oil exploration is carried out before other problems are settled, it will be a recipe for more conflict and instability in the area. And so far as I can tell, that's already happened.
I think though that's absolutely true that if, you know, currently the resource basis of the violence in Somalia is rather meager. Right. Mm-hmm. Luckily, I mean, if you compare it with other places, probably also with South Sudan or with Nigeria, possibly, or maybe with the Congo, of course, mm-hmm. where you have extremely valuable natural resources in masses like oil or gold or rare earths or stuff like that. So far, Somalia has not yet been a place where this type of resources has been profitably extracted. There's a lot of talk about oil which could be found off the shores of Somalia or also in some areas inside Somalia, including northern Somalia, but also southern Somalia. But as far as I know, the oil extraction so far has not really started. And I would say this is a blessing, because once you have this type of resource, which is really extractable from Somalia, this will be just fueling the conflict eternally. Currently, the resource basis of all the warring groups in Somalia is rather small. I mean, you know, Al-Shabaab finances itself by taxing the local population, including the local farmers, taxing trade and smuggling. Everybody tries to extract some resources from the big ports like Kismayo, Mogadishu. So there is a few, you know, banana plantations and other plantations in southern Somalia. But the resource basis is rather small. I mean, we're talking about, you know, millions, hundreds of millions, but not billions, you know, which can be made in southern Somalia per year. So I think Al-Shabaab is surviving on roughly 70 million per year, which they extract largely from the local population and also from smuggling and stuff like that. But all this would look very different if oil is really extracted and exported from Somalia.
Well, the issue is who's got the legal authority to contract with various corporations that might want to develop the oil resource, right? I mean, if they contract, say, with Somaliland, then they have an interest in Somaliland surviving because they want their legal contract to survive, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, currently, I would say from a realistic point of view, there's no authority which has the legitimacy to enter in these kind of contracts. Mm-hmm. Formally, it would be the government in Mogadishu. Mm-hmm. But as we already said, factually, the government in Mogadishu doesn't really control much of the country. And of course, Somaliland, which, you know, controls a certain part of northwestern Somalia, is not a recognized country. So striking an oil deal or any other deal with the government of Somaliland in Hargeisa is always, you know, questionable. If this, you know, what legality does it have in, you know, against the backdrop of the non-recognition of Somaliland? So I think currently there's, and since basically more than three decades, there's a lot of legal insecurity.
You are listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. After this short break, we'll get back to our conversation about Somalia with anthropology professor Marcus Virgil Hanna. That was the Wakturaha Austan Orchestra. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Here's more of our conversation about Somalia with Professor Marcus Virgil Hanna.
Do you have any hope for the revival, reemergence of the Somali nation?
Yeah, I mean, currently it looks bleaker than did a few years ago. I mean, you know, there was, again, with this waxing and waning of Somali nationalism, you know, there was a moment, you know, in 2000, honestly, I think it was in 2022, 2023, when there was a fighting ongoing in northern Somalia between a militia, which is unionist, SSC Khartoumo, against the Somaliland government, which is secessionist. You know, and this unionist militia in northern Somalia got a lot of backing, you know, from Puntland, from other places, from southern Somalia. So they got a lot of support also across the globe, you know, from the global Somali diaspora, fighting against Somaliland secession for Somali unity. And for me, at least, that was a moment I was following this very, you know, very closely, because this happened in an area where I had done my research for many, many years. This was a moment when I thought, okay, if these guys now really, you know, win against Somaliland and they have all this backing from all the other Somalis, this would be an opportunity to really make a point about unity, about Somali nationalism, about coming together, you know, for the sake of reestablishing Somalia. But unluckily, you know, after a peak of this sentiment, I would say in 2023, when after this militias in SSC Khartoumo militias had won against Somaliland, you know, there was a certain moment when it looked like that. And earlier this year, actually in February, still, I mean, the Somali Prime Minister visited this area, this militia-controlled area, and raised the Somali flag, and you could think that, you know, this is a glorious moment for the future of Somalia. But at the same time, you know, again, more and more fragmentation became visible. So Puntland in northeastern Somalia is kind of in conflict with the government in Mogadishu, and everybody who doesn't like the government in Mogadishu tries to find some external allies, and eventually even Puntland is, entered into some communication with the secessionist government of Somaliland. And these kind of militias which were fighting for Somali unity in 2022, 2023 are kind of isolated at the moment. So at this very moment, I would say I'm a little bit, I'm a little bit hopeless because, it seems that all the political actors in Somalia cannot agree on a common aim. Let's say development for all Somalis, peace for all Somalis. Education and a prosperous future for the whole young generation. They somehow cannot agree on that. They only think about their own smaller groups, clan/regional groupings. Puntland thinks about Puntland, Jubaland about Jubaland, Somaliland about Somaliland. And those guys who were fighting for unity, I would say SSC Khartoumo, who were fighting for Somali unity in northern Somalia recently, they are a little bit isolated at the moment. And even the government in Mogadishu, which would have the obligation, that's their mandate, to bring all Somalis together. This government under Hassan Sheikh Mahamud currently is not taking the right steps which convince Somalis that there's something in for them. Now, again, it's corrupt. It's just playing tit-for-tat games. It strikes intransparent deals with external powers, including Turkey. I'm wondering where are the Somali leaders who really convincingly represent the interest of the nation? I don't see any at the moment, unluckily.
I hate to report such a bleak story. I'm not even sure.
Okay, so you asked me this question.
I know I asked you the question and it may be real. I mean, okay, look, the response to that might well be, okay, well, let them feed each other to the wolves, which is what's going on with them trying to sell, each of them trying to sell their resources to some foreign entity like the UAE or Turkey or the US or various oil companies. Okay, let them do that.
Yeah, that's what the elite is doing. So you can also ask me another question. So, okay, so where do you have any hope for Somalia? That's in a way what your question was, right? So, yeah, looking at the political actors, I'm really disappointed, I have to say. And also I sense this disappointment also across Somali social media. I mean, of course, only the part of the social media in which I'm involved. But, I see and speak and read what some, I speak with some people and I read what they write, who come from really different corners of Somalia. And, I found that they also exhibit a certain depression currently about the political elite. At the same time, you can also switch the discourse and say, okay, what is really going on in Somalia beyond elite politics? And there's a lot of interesting stuff going on, right? Empirically, if you go on the ground, if you visit, including Somaliland, Hargeisa, but also Garowe in Puntland, I'm sure also Baidoa in the southwest, and Mogadishu, of course, the capital city. Mm-hmm. If you visit those places, you will be astonished how bristling these cities are, how much construction is going on, how much new businesses are opening literally every week, how active people are, despite the fact that Al-Shabaab has positions just 50 kilometers outside of Mogadishu. Mogadishu is a bristling city, and the security inside the city has actually improved over the last few years. This is one thing that the current government has been doing good, investing more into surveillance technology, CCTV cameras, training the Somali police better, and so on and so forth. So this is an empirical finding I also received from talking with a lot of people from Mogadishu in the last few months, actually. So the security situation inside the city is much better than it used to be like a few years ago. And at the same time, there's a lot of investment, and this is again something, a positive thing you can say about Somali society. On the one hand, they can easily be fragmented, right? But this, due to this, lineage belonging or this kinship networks, which always, go from whatever clan to subclan to lineage to extended family and so on and so forth. At the same time, due to the fact that Somalis are all connected along kinship lines, these connections hold water even among those Somalis who fled the country decades ago. You know, the Somali diasporas in the US, the Somali diasporas in Europe and in many other places, Asia, the Arab Peninsula, South Africa, all of them are connected. And once a Somali person, you know, established him or herself, let's say somewhere in the US or somewhere in Europe, this person will start thinking about the development of his or her people back home in Somalia. And they will sponsor, you know, they sponsor school children. They establish shops. They establish restaurants, hotels. They build houses. They build roads. So in a way, the Somali diaspora is doing what the broken state cannot do. In a way, the Somali diaspora is a transnational form of governance, which, of course, on a rather localized level, because they always support their own kin group. But they build roads, they build hospitals, they build schools, they pay the teachers, they provide medical equipment, they open stores, cafes, restaurants, they provide for the schooling of their nephews and nieces back home in Somalia. And this is at the same, while the government is broken, while the Somali leaders are very corrupt and only divisive, the society is, so to say, trying to make up for that. The only problematic aspect of it is this is not a general social movement, but this is a clan-based or family-based movement. So the rich uncle in Minneapolis will not sponsor a school or a hospital for everybody in Somalia, but he will sponsor a school for his paternal cousins. You understand the point?
Yeah, yeah. Or, well, I get the idea that there's a Dubalante diaspora supporting SC Katamo.
Yeah, of course. Yes. I mean, diaspora supports everything. They support humanitarian projects, but they support also military projects if necessary. They do not have any, you know, they do whatever is necessary. If it's necessary to fight, they provide support for the fight. They provide money for ammunition and arms and everything. But at the same time, when it's the time to build a hospital, they support building a hospital. They are full of complexities and contradictions. It's not, I cannot somehow tell a simple story about it because, as you said, I mean, you can have a whole lecture about all the things which go wrong in Somalia. And there's lots of stuff going wrong in Somalia, which I tried to answer to you after one question. But at the same time, a lot of amazing stuff is going on. You know, for instance, the internet in Somalia is much better than anywhere else in the Horn of Africa. So this is a Somali initiative. Yeah, it's much better than in Ethiopia. And you have mobile money. You have mobile money transfer. You can transfer money from anywhere in the world to anywhere in Somalia within minutes by now. I can, you know, go to Germany, in my hometown, to a Somali guy. I say, send my friend $100. And within 2 minutes, he has $100, regardless where he is in Somalia. So these things are amazing, you know, and this is also how Somali society survives. This is part of Somali resilience. They are extremely flexible, extremely, how do you say, adaptable. They can adapt to many circumstances, and they are extremely creative when it comes to solving certain problems, like survival problems particularly.
Okay, Marcus Hanna, thank you for speaking to Pacifica Radio.
Thank you very much, Anne. Welcome.
And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by myself, Ann Garrison, and the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.